Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf, recording in my home office with potential special guest appearances, maybe from the cat. She was freaking out this morning. So be prepared. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. Today, I'm very excited to have director, camera person, Kirsten Johnston here with me. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi. This is thrilling.
Kirsten's in a closet. It's great.
Yes, I am so in the closet. I'm in the same closet that appears in my movie. Yes. Yeah.
It's wild. I feel like I'm taking a tour through your movie. And speaking of your movie, please let me introduce you with a full bio so I can talk about that movie.
Right on.
Kirsten is a cinematographer and director interested in addressing the changing dimensions and urgent ethical challenges of documentary camera work. In 2004, she and Katie Cheveny co-directed the Berlinale premiering Deadline, which won the Thurgood Marshall Award, and the bulk of the next decade, however, had Kirsten focusing more as cinematographer. Her camera work has appeared in the Academy Award-winning Citizen Four, Cannes premiered Risk, Academy Award-nominated The Invisible War, Tribeca documentary winner Pray the Devil Back to Hell, Cannes winner Fahrenheit 9/11, and Emmy Award-winning Ladies First. She also shared the Sundance 2010 Cinematography Award with Laura Poitras for their work on The Oath. In 2015, she dove back into directing and controlling the narrative with her short, The Above, which premiered at the New York Film Festival and was nominated for the International Documentary Association Best Short Award for 2016. Then, in 2016, her feature, Camera Person, premiered at Sundance and was shortlisted for an Academy Award. It won the National Board of Review Freedom of Expression Prize and was awarded 3 2017 Cinema Eye honors, including an outstanding nonfiction feature. Camera Person was named one of the top 10 films of 2016 by the New York Times and the Washington Post, was the Grand Jury Prize winner of 9 international festivals, won the Ari Cinematography Award, and is distributed by the Criterion Collection. I remember Sundance that year and the very long line to get into your movie that I did not make.
No way.
So
well,
bitter.
I hope you've seen it since.
I have. So moving on. In 2017, she was awarded the Chicken and Egg Breakthrough Filmmaker Award, and she is a Sundance Art of Nonfiction Fellow, a 2017 Guggenheim Fellow, and was recently invited to be one of the 4% of ASC members who are women. And hopefully that number will be climbing soon. And now you have the opportunity to see her new film, Dick Johnson is Dead, a sometimes hilarious, sometimes wincingly sad meditation on the relationship of Kirsten and her father as they face a certain future and try to ward it off together by imagining all the wicked ways he may die. So, Kirsten.
That was impressive. Oh my goodness. You knocked me out.
Thanks. And that movie is available to watch on Netflix right now. So you guys can watch it before or after the episode. But Kirsten, the movie that you chose to talk about today is a bit unexpected, to be sure. But the more that I watched it, the more I realized how much these two films had in common. And that movie is Jackass. Can you give us explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films? I mean, it's a great action film. It's remarkable.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, I have to say, like, you know, there's a thing when you work in documentary and you work on social justice documentaries that people imagine you have no sense of humor. So one of my favorite things to do is say, you know, which films influenced me in making Dick Johnson is Dead? And it's like Harold and Maude, you know, Groundhog Day, Jackass. Mm-hmm. And people are just like, what? You know, it immediately gets a laugh.
Yes.
So I have to say that Jackass, for me, the experience of seeing it just brought me into the territory of so many feelings that I didn't expect. And I found myself both physically gagging multiple mm-hmm. times, as well as laughing hysterically. And, you know, the sort of anticipatory feelings one has watching Jackass, which is, you know, the series of pranks or gags or physical risks that this group of people mm-hmm. do together. Like sometimes it's the anticipation that's even more powerful than the actual act itself. And all of that felt like it really resonated with me and what we were trying to do together with my dad for Dick Johnson Is Dead.
Yes, absolutely. For those of you who haven't seen Jackass, this is a point where I usually say that today's episode is going to give you some spoilers and you shouldn't stop listening. It's my motto is that what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching still. But this one, I think that you should just watch it. Just go ahead, rent it. And also, there's no way that we can spoil any of this because, as Kirsten said, it is a lot about the anticipation, a lot about the kind of construction of this. And honestly, some of the camera work, and even though it seems a little bit novice, like, we're going to dissect some of that. Oh. Now, you guys are back. You've watched it. So let me introduce Jackass by just telling you some of the gags so that you can remember what happened. Written by the entire cast and directed by Jeff Tremaine for release in 2002, Jackass the movie is a nonlinear patchwork of legendary stunts and pranks. To jog your memories, let me highlight some from the film. Renting a car and putting it through a demolition derby. Attaching a muscle stimulator to various areas of the body, including the balls and taint. Speeding a golf cart down a hill until Johnny Knoxville is knocked unconscious. A small alligator biting Johnny Knoxville's nipple.
Oh, fuck! He's got my nipple, dude. He's got my fucking nipple.
Wee man Acuna trying to bash cement blocks with his head and failing miserably. Steve-O dangling chicken from his jock strap over a pond of hungry alligators.
Hi, I'm Steve-O, and this is Alligator Tightrope.
Dave England taking a shit in a display toilet. Aaron McGahey crawling across a floor full of mouse traps, Chris Rabe bungee jumping from his underwear, the cast traipsing around Tokyo streets in giant panda costumes, roller skating in the back of a moving truck,
God, this party sucks.
Steve-O snorting wasabi, hiding an alligator in Bam's mother's kitchen. Ryan Dunn giving Johnny Knoxville and Steve-O paper cuts on all their most sensitive skin. Johnny Knoxville fighting heavyweight champion Butterbean in a department store.
And by knockout in the first round, new champion, Butterbean.
Woo, yeah!
Steve-O and Chris Pontius filling their suits with shrimp to swim with hungry sharks. Steve-O getting a giant back tat of himself. And Steve-O also getting a smiley face tattoo in the back of a dune buggy driven by wildly by Henry Rollins. Launching fireworks from their anuses. Aaron McGahey eating his own yellow snow cone. Bam beating up his dad, Phil, and while Phil is on the toilet. The cast blowing an air horn on the fourth hole of a golf course to startle golfers. Johnny and Bam dropping from an office ceiling, scaring the temp workers inside. Ryan Dunn putting a tiny car up his ass, then going to an x-ray technician who tells him to be discreet about the incident.
You think maybe I can just, you know, poop it out?
You won't be able to poop it out. In fact, it will hurt you. In fact, I don't think it's even good for you that you poop it out.
What will happen if you take X-Lax? Will that help?
No, they get excited when he gets a lot of diarrhea, but no cop.
And finally, the cast being made up as old men and navigating through explosions, mountain lions, and falling wreckage. And there we go. That's pretty much it.
Wow, you did it. Yeah. Okay, just listening to you go through that, I was both like laughing, wincing, like it hurts physically even to hear you describe some of those things, which I think is part of the genius of Jackass.
I know.
And I also love, like, Jackass is such an experimental movie, right? Like,
yes.
There is no plot, but there are always stakes.
I mean, that's like some of the best writing. And I think that's something that they actually know how to do quite well, is how to raise something. Even if a gag doesn't work, they know how to make it like turn in on itself. So you have a full story arc, which is wild to think about. But I want to get into first the fact that these are absolute and complete novices who are doing this movie. And they've been doing the television show for three series before they went back and did this. But it didn't mean that they had any skills or techniques. And they were a hodgepodge of people who really hadn't directed or done camera work before. And so there's so much learning on the fly that they did. I looked at the old production notes from the release of the film and found some really wonderful quotes. But the production notes said, quote, "There is no key grip. Historically, key grips have been used on films since who knows when, but since no one on the formal Jackass crew had any idea what a key grip is or even does, the occupation was simply tossed by the wayside in favor of more important sounding titles such as director, executive producer, director of photography, et al. So it goes with exuberant amateurs in a professional world." End quote. I'm like, what?
Yeah, and the key grip being the person who's responsible for safety, right?
Yes. I mean, it's wild that they just didn't have any of that. And they were like, well, I guess you're going to be the director. You're going to be the executive producer. Even Jeff Tremaine is just like, I guess I was a director.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there are these sort of incredible moments like where one of the camera people is so physically repulsed by what's happening that he's like holding back his gag reflux, and he ends up like half choking himself and falling over with the camera because he can't hold it together physically.
Yes.
But I mean, it's interesting what you say about being a novice, April, because mm-hmm. I sort of feel like every time we make a film, we are a complete novice because we have never made a film with these particular stakes before. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I truly love about Jackass is sort of the love and camaraderie between these guys. Like, they are all taking these very real risks, not knowing what the outcome will be, putting themselves in like these crazy positions, and then all standing around and laughing at each other, mm-hmm. but also like ready to run in and, you know, sort of like, are you okay? But I think there's nothing you could do that would prepare you to make this movie.
No.
Or you wouldn't do it. And in some ways, there was sort of nothing I could do that would prepare me to make Dick Johnson Is Dead either.
You know, there's something about, too, that your films and the way that the camera work works with them, because the person that you're referencing who had to hold back his gagging, who was like throwing up on camera, I believe that was Lance Bangs. He
exactly
was the he was just the BTS. He was behind the scenes camera. He wasn't even the main camera. And so you're talking about what that is and the kind of blurring lines, you know,
right?
When in your film, you have these like specific setups where there's like, OK, there's an official camera, but then who is the camera who's documenting the official right. camera and all of that.
And, you know, you're talking to a documentarian. So when you say just the BTS,
exactly, yeah, yeah.
I'm like, the BTS is the heart of the matter,
yeah.
right? Because the behind the scenes is where people are unguarded, where people are not thinking about how they are being seen. They are simply being. And I wrote down like a crazy sort of list of lines that people say in this movie that yes. are caught by the behind the scenes audio. This is wrong. This is wrong. Oh, don't catch me crying like a girl. Don't look. It hurts so much. Getting the shit kicked out of me by a girl. I can't really look cool right now. I don't give two fucks. Like, all of those are like the expression of being vulnerable, being exposed, like being impotent as a person, mm-hmm. and particularly in this case, like as a man, right? Mm-hmm. But I just found it sort of like amazing what the behind the scenes camera was getting in terms of the relationship of all of these men, which yes. I find like incredibly moving.
And which we'll find, I think, as we go through the discussion, that they ditched their, you know, main camera so many times to go with the footage that was the quote unquote behind the scenes.
Absolutely.
And that's, I think, just a really lovely means. I didn't get the problem with this research that I've done is that I wasn't able to get much info on the editing or from the editor and how that cut together, which is wild because this is actually quite well edited, especially if I think about that scene where Johnny Knoxville is getting shot in the stomach with a beanbag, for instance. It is
incredible tension in that scene, right? Incredible. Yeah, you know, Priya Swami Nathan is one of the people who enabled Dick Johnson Is Dead to come to life. Mm-hmm. And she cold called me after seeing Camera Person and just wanted to talk to me about the film and then said, you know, what are you making next? And I said, well, I've had this crazy dream about my dad and I want to make this movie that would be kind of like Harold and Maude, kind of like Jackass. And she burst into laughter and she said, did you know that I produced Jackass 3 and Bad Grandpa? And I was like, no. And we got into this really interesting discussion about the editing of Camera Person by the extraordinary Nels Bangerter. Mm-hmm. And also the incredible like run up to the film by Amanda Laws. And Priya was saying like that she finds the editing of Jackass to be among the most sophisticated editing in popular cinema.
It is.
Which, you know, right? Because there's no narrative. There's no narrative that we're following, but we are gripped almost at every moment of the movie.
There's also, I mean, certain points where they need to decide what the out is of a scene. For instance, that first scene with the demolition derby, they really didn't have an ending to it, you know? And so they were just like, well, what do we do? And in the commentary, I thought it was really wonderful where Johnny Knoxville was just like, had no idea how to end it. I had just given this rental car back and they were like, who are you? So he just ran out and grabbed those two blow up dolls and started walking across the street. And according to Johnny Knoxville, there was actually quite a bit more footage that followed of, you know, this guy chasing him across the street and saying something to the camera, but they ended up slicing that off because it didn't feel like it gave like a circular kind of completeness to the scene.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is an interesting tension in the film. And certainly, like, I would say, like, it's at the edge of racism with some of the stuff they're doing in Japan, mm-hmm. right? Where they can't communicate with the crowds around them. But for me, I find that they are generally like they're not trying to punk people in the world. It's more like an internal world of like, what do they dare do? How can they sort of stand up to authority, whether it's their parents or it's, you know, wealthy people on a golf course, right? Like, how can they be transgressive? But mm-hmm. you don't sense them like wanting to hurt people's feelings or like make social commentary. Like, say, Borat is like, you know, trying to engage with serious social commentary yep. in some of the pranks that he's doing. What it feels like to me is they're experiencing together these questions of, you know, what do we do with pain?
Yes.
And I wanted to bring to the conversation Minding the Gap by Bing Liu, who made this incredible film about skateboarders, right? And you know, I'm really tall. Like, I fall off a skateboard if I even try to step on it.
I shattered my ankle skateboarding because I have a very wrong center of gravity. I get it.
Right? Like, so, you know, so I know nothing about skateboarding. It wasn't until Bing's film that it occurred to me, like, oh, you know, all these guys in Bing's film are sort of escaping the violence of their homes. Mm-hmm. I will say nothing of anyone on the Jackass crew because I don't know, but you get the impression they understand pain and they're trying to do something new with pain.
Yeah.
You know, and the other film that I want to bring up that's just amazing is Kirby Dick's film Sick, about Barry Flanagan, who was born with cystic fibrosis and then becomes a sadomasochistic performance artist.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like people finding ways to make something out of their pain, to transform it into something that they have some agency over. They don't have control over it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's really interesting to me in Jackass. And I didn't know when I first watched it what I know now, having watched Bing's film, about like, oh, right. Like, okay, maybe they're escaping some other kind of pain by doing this pain.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Steve-O talks about that like later in his life. He's talked about that. And, you know, we'll get a little bit to that too. But there's also the quote that I wanted to get from Johnny Knoxville and Ryan Dunn that speaks to what you're saying. And Johnny Knoxville said, quote, "We weren't trying to change any social values or lower or raise any bars. We were and still are just trying to make people laugh." And Dunn said, "It's just raw and it'll make people forget about everything for a short period of time. They can forget about work and about waking up in the morning. All they have to do is relax and just have fun for an hour and a half," end quote. And I mean, it gets to that where it's just like they're like, even
totally.
By not having a focus on social things, like they have a focus, like there's it's almost,
totally.
Do you know?
No. And so interesting that say just have fun. Like, it is so not just fun.
No.
Like, it's like you're literally like trying to hold yourself back from throwing up and you're like wincing and like, you know, so it's not just fun, but it is definitely escapism. And I think the other thing that's so like interesting to me about this concept of escapism, right? It's like the idea is we escape our lives, but do we escape our bodies? No, this is a film that grounds us back in our bodies. You mm-hmm. feel things in your body that you cannot control while you are watching it. I think that's the thing that like totally blew me away about the experience of, you know, seeing it. Like, I start giggling hysterically, like in the scene going on the tightrope over the alligator pit.
Yes.
Like, it just like gets me, I can't stop this sort of hysterical laughter coming from my body.
And you can also, I mean, like one of the greatest parts about that too, is that because there's a chorus of those guys, you can hear their giggles and it kind of feeds into it of just like, everyone's very nervous at this point.
Yeah, because it's like, oh, this is bad. Like, Steve-O's like, and the visual of like a giant alligator behind his butt, like ready to snap at him, you're just like, no. So yes, that communal laughter. So catharsis was the other word I wanted to bring to you, April. Like, I feel like it's a deeply cathartic movie.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a lot more Jackass and a lot more Dick Johnson is Dead. We'll be right back.
Well, hello. I'm Renee Colvert.
Hi, I'm Alexis Preston, and we are the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog?
And we got breaking news, we got an exposé, and all the beans have been spilled via an Apple Podcast review that said, this show isn't well-researched. Well, yeah, no duh. Of course it's not. Not since the day we started has it been well-researched. Guessing and anthropomorphizing dogs is what we do.
The Can I Pet Your Dog promise is that we will never do more than 10 seconds of research before telling you excitedly about any dog we see.
I'm going to come at you with top 10 enthusiasm, minimal facts.
We're here for a good time, not an educated time.
So if you love dogs and you don't love research, well, you know what? Come on in to Can I Pet Your Dog podcast every Tuesday on Maximum Fun Network.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today from a closet by Kirsten Johnson, and we're talking about Jackass. Something I wanted to bring up is Jeff Tremaine talking about how they actually dream up their skits, which is kind of a loosely associated kind of like spitball type of thing. He said, quote, ideas come from everywhere. Sometimes the cast will come up with the idea, like Bam called me with an idea to have Rabe himself jump out of a tree with bungee cords attached to his underwear. Or someone will have the start of an idea and we'll discuss it to figure out the next step of it. Lots of times the ideas just take off in altogether different directions. But if they involve Pontius or Steve-O, there's probably going to be some nudity involved, end quote. I think it's an interesting thing because Johnny Knoxville also talks about this in a different part of the research that I found. And essentially that is that getting wasted is part of their process and getting
right.
Like
you can definitely see evidence of that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, getting wasted in some ways is the breaking down of inhibition, mm-hmm. right? It's also like anesthesia, right? And I think, you know, there's a way in which like, oh, like blackout drinking means you can't remember
yes.
anything that happened to you,
yeah.
right? And it's a social lubricant, as it were, right? Like it's functioning as a lubricant for all this behavior. But I think one of the things that I just find like mind-blowing about this is like they're going beyond shame.
Mm-hmm.
And like the stakes, like I said before, like the stakes are so high. Like Bam pulls these pranks on his parents,
yeah,
right? So the stakes are really high, and the sort of, it's not just your reputation, it's also your family's reputation. I'm mixing up the words reputation and representation. You know,
yeah.
This is one of the challenges for me with Dick Johnson is Dead. It's like, can I do this to my father's reputation? You know,
yeah.
My father was a respected psychiatrist in Seattle. Can I make a movie in which I kill him over and over again that is a comedy about him having dementia and dying? You know, there's stakes in that. And so that, you know, when Bam, you know, has Phil and April, his mother, like in this situation where they might be exposed. Like one of the things he's trying to do is get his mom to say the word fuck. And
yeah.
he, you know, they leave a giant alligator in the kitchen and she's freaking out, right? There's a like putting things on the line in this movie that I find really beautiful. And I think the other thing for me that I think about a lot is when you feel yourself to be invisible as a person, like you have not been represented and the world doesn't see you, there's even sort of higher stakes in the way that you represent yourself.
Yeah.
And I think these guys are saying there's something about class in this, there's something about desire in this that sort of speaks to these really big questions about like, okay, you think I'm not able to do these things. Oh, yes, I am. So there's like a proving yourself, like making visible the most exposed and most vulnerable parts of yourself and then not giving two fucks, right?
Yeah. Do you feel like you've had that before where you've felt the need to prove yourself in these ways?
Oh, you know, I would say on one level, I didn't even imagine. I mean, I would come in more on like the shame level, mm-hmm. like sort of the shame of not making work that's good enough, whatever that's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised a Seventh-day Adventist. I was a really believing kid. I believe that God saw all of my thoughts, mm-hmm. right? So I couldn't even take his name in vain, let alone like use the language that I'm daring to use on this show, right? Like,
yeah.
Obviously, I'm quoting people saying, I don't give yes. two fucks, right?
Yeah, you can't see her air quotes, but she is saying.
I'm totally air quoting because I would never say that in a public space, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so I, and then I would say, you know, coming out of my mother's trauma, which is she's driving the car on her way to her college graduation, a drunk driver hits that car, her mother is killed beside my mother. And sort of from that point forward in my mother's life, she didn't want to make any more irreparable mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So she was being a careful person. She cared about reputation, loyalty, image. And I honored that very late into my career as a filmmaker. I made really like good films. I made films about social justice. I made films that were trying to make change in the world. I made films about racism within the criminal justice system, right? I transferred the good to like political progressive ideas from religion,
yeah.
but there's no transgression in the work. And there's a lot of transgression in Camera Person and a lot of transgression and doubt in Dick Johnson is Dead.
Yeah, it's opening new doors for you. And in many ways, if I look at those two different types of your, stories of your career, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's certain things that are sacred, right? And that I do believe to be sacred. Like in some ways, other people's pain is sacred and it's theirs to represent. My own pain, my father's pain, together we collaborated on being transgressive with it. Mm-hmm. On saying like death, sorry, you can't have us. Dementia, sorry. Like we're not only going to cry, we're going to laugh at you. But you can't necessarily do that with other people's stuff,
yeah.
Which I think is sort of key to Jackass. Like they're doing it to their own bodies.
Yes.
Right. If they were doing it to other people's bodies, this would be beyond transgressive and not acceptable at all.
Yeah. And you can get like the emotional pain or like embarrassment from the people that they are kind of pranking, but those people still have to sign releases. They still have
sure.
to sign the releases to be on there. And Johnny Knoxville has a funny story about the golfing thing on the fourth hole of like approaching the men afterwards, like before they get the releases and being like, oh yeah, man, I'm a golfer too. I get it. And then buying them rounds of beers. And then they are like, they sign the releases for it.
Because it's like getting people in on the joke, right?
Exactly.
And I do think like there's a way in which like punking is like playing a joke on someone and then them getting beyond their mortification or their shame of being fooled or revealing something about themselves. So that golfer's just like so angry and then starts hitting golf balls at them when they've blown the air horn on him a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And like, of course, that's like humiliating that you've been filmed with this much anger, but then there's also a pride, right? Like,
yeah,
like that happened. I was a part of that. So if you think in my film, Dick Johnson is Dead, of Ray DiMaggio, who's my father's best friend, who's weeping at the end of my father's funeral,
yes.
you know, uncomforted. There are a lot of people who've seen the film and said, you know, wow, is he okay? Like he was there, like really losing it emotionally after that. Did he know the funeral wasn't real? And of course he knew, he was totally in on it, but he went there. You know, he's a 91-year-old man
mm-hmm.
who knows more about death than any of us. He doesn't know what it's like yet, but he knows it's like closer
yeah.
to him than it is to us. And he came to the premiere at Sundance and he was just like, I made this film. I went there emotionally. If not for me, this film would have no heart. You know, he was kidding, but he loved that he is shown weeping uncontrollably in the film.
That actually brings me to this other point that I wanted to bring up when it comes to Jackass. And that is, so Trip Taylor's the EP. He said, quote, no one who shoots with us is off limits, from producers to cameramen. It doesn't matter whom you are or what position you hold. And then Jeff Tremaine added, That's one of the best things about working on a production. There's absolutely no line between the crew and the cast. Everyone who is around is vulnerable to being caught on camera, and everyone needs to know that, including me. One time on the set, for example, I was kind of stressing out because a couple of things weren't working out for this big bit we were going to shoot. And while I was stressing out, one of the guys runs up behind me with some hair clippers and cuts a big patch out of my hair so no one is off limits, end quote. And I'm again, you know, we're talking about like the blurring between the behind the scenes, behind the reality, behind all of this, and you know, who's comfortable being on camera, being caught on camera, and your dad's friend, you know, like that was, it could have been invasive if he wasn't just like ready for the camera to be on him in these moments where he had to step aside.
I love that. I love how radical they are. Like, yeah. You know, cinema, the history of cinema comes from this hierarchy that's military hierarchy, right? That there are people above other people. And in their conception, they are saying, we are all equal. We are all vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, in the way that camera person emerged, the sort of discovery for me of like, yeah, I'm there too when we're making a movie, even though you don't see me, the translator is there too. You know, the driver of the truck is there. The sound person is there. So this exposing all of the people it takes to make a film is what I'm really interested in, because mm-hmm. I feel like all of us are in a relationship together, and that's part of how a film emerges. So for me, like, the idea of stunt people was just so juicy, because it's like, oh, here's this person who puts their life on the line, literally on behalf of a film in which they will be invisible. Mm-hmm. So with Dick Johnson Is Dead, it's like, okay, the stunt person becomes part of the crew, but is also in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. So I love what they're saying about their crew. And that's very much how we thought about our crew. And, you know, there's a scene in the film where everyone who's worked on the film is there behind the Halloween set. Like, just to say, like, it takes this many people mm-hmm. doing all these separate things to make a film.
You know, there's also something that I wanted to bring up with regard to your film and how it relates to this. And that is the gentleman that you interview. It feels like it's an impromptu interview. And he says yes. that his mother drowned. And
yeah, it was his father.
His father yes. drowned.
And, yeah,
and
yeah.
I think Mike. that's something that relates to this, I believe. And can you express how that actually came about, that interview?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, I have this trait. I think I learned it from my father, who learned it from his grandfather. I mean, from his father, my grandfather. So my grandfather, Elmer Johnson, you know, was one of many brothers. The family were farmers. Elmer really wanted to be a doctor. There was not enough money in the family to do so. He became a gardener, worked as a landscape gardener his whole life, mm-hmm. right? So did physical labor his whole life. And he was this incredibly gentle man. And my dad, from my whole life, like, always speaks to anybody with, like, not just full respect for them as a person, but just sort of a curiosity of what's your inner struggle.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, Mike is someone who works in the building that my dad's been in. We had his psychiatric office there for many years, and Mike's the handyman in the building, right? And he came to help us take down the shelves. And both my dad and I wanted him to be in on what was happening. So, you know, I told him what the movie was about. Dad was explaining it to him. And then I asked the question, you know, are both of your parents alive? Because that's the thing I've been doing with this process the whole way, April, mm-hmm. is like, talk, it's a back and forth. So, you know, April, one of the questions I ask everybody, and I asked Mike, which is, you know, part of how all that opened up, is, April, have you ever thought about how you might wish to die?
Yes.
Ha! Let's hear it.
I would like to go like my Uncle Jerry, who was watching football on TV one night and just passed in his sleep. He'd had,
he
like,
just
a
fell
nice...
asleep during the game.
Yeah, he
so
fell asleep.
So are you going to fall asleep watching a movie?
I think I'd probably fall asleep watching a baseball game. And
yeah, well, anybody would.
And I think it'd be a nice way to go. If only Vince Scully's voice could be the person who lulls me to my
soothes
my sleepy
you
death.
To your death.
Yeah, that would yeah. be nice.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting because you're in your sleeper, again with the air quotes. There's a lot of people who believe they want to die in their sleep, right? And I think part of it is you want to die without pain.
Yeah.
You want to not know it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of interestingly, like, the question mark in that for me, like, having worked on this film, is like, What about the people who love you? Will that make them happy that you've died in their sleep? Like, it'll be a different thing if you're a 90-year-old lady or a 100-year-old lady than if it happened tomorrow.
Yeah.
And right, like, and the sort of, there's a lack of anticipation in that death, right? Nobody gets to know what's about to happen. Not you, not them. And what I think is really powerful about this moment in time that we're all in with the coronavirus pandemic is we're all engaged with anticipatory grief. Like, if we haven't lost someone or know someone, I mean, there's a lot of humans we have already died who we mourn, then we have people we're worried about them dying. And then, and some part of it, we're worried about ourselves dying. So we're like all engaged with new levels of anticipation, which I think is so much what this film is about. Like, it's always like the anticipation of what they're about to do that really gets you emotionally.
I think, well, I should be transparent in the fact that I lost my grandfather the day that your movie came out. He raised me, so he was my father for most of my life. And it was the day your movie came out, and then I watched your movie because I just still wanted to see it. I'd wanted to see it since January, but I just sat there and I had a really good, wonderful cry. And, and you know, then I flew home to be with my family. But it was, it's something that I think about quite a bit. About, you know, I grew up very Catholic, and you start thinking about death very early when you are very religious in that sense. And, you know, I think that a meditation on death can come in many different ways. And, you know, the way that you're talking about kind of warding it off or trying to have the anticipation of it, it's so strange that when I was watching Jackass, the emotions that I had when I watched your movie were transferred onto that. And these men who are kind of trying to defy death. And this is something, I brought up this quote earlier, and I wanted to bring this up, that Steve-O's essentially kind of idea of life. He said, quote, "I don't want to die. I just expect too soon. Since I was a little kid, I've always predicted death to be sooner than later. But if you can tell me some secret info about me living for a long time, then my art is out the window," end quote. And I thought that that was just something really lovely that he, and this is in the middle of an interview where he was talking about fucking girls at his old alma mater and just like getting STDs and shit. And then in the middle of that, he drops this. And I know that he doesn't want to be serious. I know that these men kind of don't want to take these things seriously. But that is, to me, the idea of Jackass, the idea of your movie is like, I don't want to die. I expect to soon, but I'm going to try to defy it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, and the sort of the vulgar and the profound together.
Yes.
Will you tell me the name of your grandfather and tell us something about him?
Bob Kale. And I'm wearing a shirt from his bar that he ran, Kale's Corner Bar.
He ran a bar.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, we grew up in a neighborhood bar, and he was a fascinating man who was orphaned when he was young, couldn't walk until he was 5 because he was held in a crib for a very long time and wasn't allowed to walk, and then forged his own way through life and had a really loving family who cared about him deeply.
Oh, how beautiful. Yeah. And I'm sure was beloved by all the people in the bar.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, even with coronavirus, the funeral, so many people walked through socially distant with masks and shared so many wonderful stories that are very hilarious. And and that's one of my favorite things about your movie, too, is the fact that you show that death can also be kind of like catharsis we were talking about, the fun stories, the hilarious things that you did along the way and like sharing those. And I really appreciate that.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who have no choice about the pain they have to experience. Like someone who was like not allowed to leave his crib as a baby. Like that's a human who has had to contend with emotional violence from the beginning of their lives.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And what I've found traveling all over the world and filming with people who've survived genocides and who live in poverty or, you know, have experienced abuse, some of those people, not all of them, but some of them end up by surviving through really laughing and really being funny and storytelling, right?
Yep.
And also like a huge capacity for empathy with other people's experience.
Yes.
And so, you know, like I think what your grandfather experienced, my dad somehow like transmitted through generations from his father, like knows that other people hurt and they may be doing a great job of hiding it. You know, and it, you gotta, like, anybody who owns a bar knows that people hurt.
Yeah.
And that they need to be there in some kind of way, right?
Well, I mean, it's like the psychology is very close to bar. I mean, like, if we think about, like, yeah. our kind of fathers and my grandfather.
Yeah, and, like, look at what we're doing with our lives, right? Like, we're creating a relationship with each other through a recording, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, my dad in his psychiatric office, your grandfather in his bar, right, are like involved in this work of listening to other people, mm-hmm. Asking questions, being, you know, hey, Felix, want to come in? My son just is interrupting coming into the closet. This is like, here we are on the radio, Felix.
Hi, Felix.
You want to say hi?
I just have a question.
He just has a question, yeah.
That's right.
Can I use your phone?
Nope, I'm recording something on it right
but
now.
But I need to do my homework.
You got to talk to dad about it.
But it's drumming homework, and he gave you it.
Okay, well, I can't stop it right now, but I'll do it in probably 10 minutes. Okay.
We're close.
Yeah, he needed my phone to do his homework. That's like so classic. Like that's the scene. Like that's how we came up with the scene in Dick Johnson Is Dead of like, yeah. I was trying to record voiceover in the closet. My dad interrupts me. Now it's my 8-year-old who interrupts me because he needs to do his homework because it's the pandemic.
With that, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get more into all of these huge philosophical things that have to do with Jackass and Dick Johnson Is Dead. We'll be right back.
I started listening to Ono, Ross, and Carrie shortly after I broke my arm.
I couldn't get my book started.
I was lost, honestly.
I knew it was time to make a change.
There's something about Ono, Ross, and Carrie that you just can't get anywhere else.
They're thought leaders, discoverers, founders.
I'd call them heroes.
Ross and Carrie don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal. They take part themselves.
They show up so you don't have to.
But you might find that you want to.
Arm is better.
I wrote an entire book this weekend. It's terrible, but I did it.
Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Thank you, Ross and Carrie.
Ono, Ross and Carrie is just a podcast. It doesn't do anything. It's just sounds you listen to in your ears. All these people are made up. Goodbye.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Kirsten Johnston, and we're talking about Jackass. Kirsten, Johnny Knoxville, who was always kind of the more man about town, more intellectualizing person of this whole Jackass crew. He was often kind of like the person who spoke for the entirety of the cast. But, you know, he also had a wife at that time. He had gotten married very young and he had a child. And he was the only one from the cast who had that, secondary family that he was, caring for and that was also worrying over him. And so he said at one point, quote, "My wife is happy that this show is finally over. She was always very afraid for me. At some point, I decided to just stop telling her what nonsense we were going to do next. It would have only made her fear worse. The subject of Jackass was simply taboo for us," end quote. And I thought that that was something interesting in terms of someone who, like yourself, has a family. You have both your father and your kids, and the idea that you are potentially going to have to go far away or shoot something that might be dangerous or weird or, you know, might take you away for also a very long time. And how do you deal with that?
Isn't that that's so interesting? I wasn't aware of that about Johnny Knoxville, and you know, I think for a long time I didn't really understand what I was doing to other people by leaving and going and working on films. And there was a moment when we were working on Citizen Four with Laura Poitras where I had gotten pregnant with twins and I'd already filmed while pregnant with her for quite a bit. And then there was a moment where she, sort of said to me, I don't think you can come with me to Tunisia was where we were going. But then eventually it was like, no, you can't come to Hong Kong and film Edward Snowden because you have children, right?
Yeah.
And I just remember like this sort of devastation of being left behind.
Yeah.
Of having to stay home with the kids.
Yeah.
And I love my kids. I am worked really hard to like bring them into the world. And yet it was like this powerful experience for the first time of being like, oh, I'm the one who's left behind. And, you know, so I think life is just so fascinating. It sort of gives us the chance to explore certain things and think we understand everything. And we're like, it's our independence and we're going out into the world. And then something shifts. Someone dies, we age, we have children, and all of a sudden we're like, oh, this is what the people around me were going through. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. You know, so when I was making Camera Person, I thought I was making it about the past, and the woman in Bosnia says to me, oh, you're making this film so your children will know who you were. And it's just like, wow. I didn't know why that wasn't what I thought I was doing. Right.
Were you like, oh, like
it was total. It was just like, boom, like it just like knocked me back on my heels. You know, and I'm really interested in time. Right. Mm-hmm. And cinema's relationship to time. So we're in the present here right now, April. Right. But you went somewhere emotionally you didn't expect to go. Talking about your grandfather, it shifted the direction of the conversation. You know, like righted yourself, got back to the question you wanted to ask. But like, we're in new territory, both of us, because there's sort of stakes, new stakes in the conversation.
Yeah.
And this is what I love about our work, right? Like sort of needing to be nimble in the moment and listen, be quiet. But one of the things that happens when you record is that then the future's out there. Like in some ways, the recording is also death, right? Because at some point in time, both of us will be dead. We don't know which one of us will die first. Maybe we'll die together.
We should put a bet on it, though.
crazy world, right? Exactly. But then this recording will have new meaning for somebody.
That's true. And, you know, in the way that I was actually, it's so funny you say that, because I was thinking about that when I was listening to the commentary for Jackass 2, of the idea that, like, these guys are like defying death, and then their families at some point in time will have to like look back as like this kind of portrait of them, of the remembering them the way that they were. And it's wild to me, you know, that would be someone's keepsake, essentially, of like,
that's right. How you know another person or how they stay alive. And so for me, like this really powerful thing about cinema is that cinema is in the constant present. Like a movie is in the present with the person who's watching it, and the person watching it is bringing themselves to the creation of the film. So the film is sort of constantly being made and remade, even if all the people in it are dead. So like watching Jackass, when those men actually are all old men, you know, like the end sequence of this movie, yes. I just think is so glorious. It's like major explosions. They're all dressed up as old men, and they're just like walking forward, and like things are hitting, you know, trucks are hitting them. They're being thrown into the air. And it's sort of like, who will be the last man standing? Mm-hmm. Will we even make it to old age? And if we do, which one of us will be last? Which one of us will be left alone? Right. And, you know, and this is this thing about loving people, right? Like you loved your grandfather so much, and now you are left without him. But the thing that I've found through the process of making this film is like, people don't die.
Yeah.
Like people do die and they don't. Like your grandfather's in this conversation. Like I'm thinking of him in his crib.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of him behind the bar. Right. And like, that's a story I'm not going to forget. And I will think about that when I listen to your next podcast, right? Like, and maybe yeah. he will come into your next podcast in a way you didn't expect. So this sort of back and forth between past, present, future that happens when we have these recorded conversations, I think that's what blows my mind about all of this. Like we're doing time travel, yeah. basically.
And you're also talking about adding this context. And it's a funny thing to think about, for instance, Jackass is almost without context. They almost specifically want it without kind of like some a rationality of like who these people are in their everyday lives, you know, like they don't exist. But when you add the context into it, like me watching or listening to this commentary, reading these interviews, I see it so differently now. And I will never not watch Jackass not thinking about Steve-O and his philosophy, or Johnny Knoxville and his philosophy, which is, hold on, let me find it. Man, it always hurts. Everything, all the time. I got knocked unconscious 3 times on the Jackass movie. I know this is going to end bad, but I'm going to pretend it's going to end good. That's my life's philosophy. And I will never not think about that. This man actually goes in and has a kind of wishful, willful thinking about him, you know, going into this demolition derby and like having glass flying into his face and saying like, it's going to end good, even though he knows it's going to end bad.
It's so, and that is like lucidity about life. Like,
it is.
We're all in denial, but this is going to end badly. We're going to die. We're all going to die, right? Like, there is no happy ending here.
No.
Like, sorry, right? But I think this thing that you're saying of like having watched the commentary, you are now transformed again in how you watch. After your father, grandfather's death, you are now transformed again as a human. And so seeing people risk their lives means a new thing to you. And this is what it is about being human. It's like, you know, we discover a blind spot and then we're like, okay, I'm done. I have no more blind spots. And then it's like, whoa, I just found like a whole nother level of blind spot. And I think that's what's so glorious about being alive, making films, watching films, is that it's like a really active acknowledgement of our humanness.
Yeah. And that's something I could think you can see. I'm going to bring it back to that Johnny Knoxville getting shot scene in his stomach.
Oh, my God.
Because there was something that they had been shot at previously in that scene, but they cut it out because the guy missed, and he missed high, and it could have like killed him. It could have hit him in the face. And so he was just sitting there. And so we don't get to see that. But what we do get to see is that Johnny Knoxville is really fucking nervous, and we don't exactly know why, because that scene was already edited out. That doesn't exist.
See, now that's one where I'm like, maybe they should have left that in, because that, you know, the guy with the gun was so cocky and is like, that's why I'm doing it, because I'm not a human. Mm-hmm. I can aim and it'll be no problem. You know, remember he said something like that, like, when I aim, I don't miss. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
Like, I remember thinking that as a camera person. I was like, actually, that's not true. You are a human. And so I kind of would have loved to see, I'm sure that footage is terrifying. And I bet in some ways they were afraid of putting it in the movie, because it's like, this is so dangerous. This is not okay to watch.
I mean, were there things that you felt like you didn't want to put into your movie because it felt like there was an element of either danger or negativity or something that you just didn't feel like serves?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, implicit for me, you know, every day of making this film is this okay to make this film with my father who has advancing dementia, right? Because dementia is a very strange disease, and you have moments of profound lucidity and you have moments of complete disconnection from the reality of who you are as a person, what you really want. And so, you know, there are moments of like complete lack of agency. So, you know, I could ask my father's permission a million times, but in the space of his dementia, there might be one time where he would say no. I don't want to be in this movie. Then what do I do with that? Right. And I think one of the things that Camera Person taught me is to own the complexity of our responsibility, but also to understand we control nothing. Right. And that I couldn't control my father's dementia, nor can I. I'm responsible for his safety. But I can't control whether or not he's going to get hurt making this movie. I can't control whether he's going to get hurt in the world, which is like those terrible decisions that so many understand of like, do I take this person's car keys away or not? Yeah. Like, it's either too early or too late. A person's agency and their independence is their selfness, right? Yeah. And Yet we all know that there are moments where we lose ourselves. Like, and you know, you look at Jackass, like, is it okay that they're doing all those stunts when they're completely drunk?
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe not, you know? I'm not sure. And, you know, we like, you think about a series as powerful as I May Destroy You, right? Like sort of visiting and revisiting these questions of what's okay around what I chose to do, what happened to me when I got drunk, what someone did to me, what I remember, right? Like, I think that, you know, post Me Too on one level, but just in the world now of more people who are not just men making movies, who are not just white people making movies, who are not just, you know, people from the Western world making movies, our forms of narrative are like exploding because we're talking about different points of subjectivity, right? And a questioning of where barriers and boundaries are. And so, you know, I mean, I think going beyond something that is a boundary or a barrier, or I'm not supposed to be there, but I'm going to go see what it looks like over there. And can I come back from there is something that many of us filmmakers are like interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yet sometimes you create an image and it's sort of more powerful than you. You're like, oh, I went further than I imagined I could go. And is it okay? So, you know, when we named this film, Dick Johnson is Dead, I woke up like kind of in a cold sweat of like, I can't say this. My father's still alive. And then I told my dad and he's like, that's hilarious. He was like, you know, like then reaction formation. I'll live forever if you call it that. Definitely call it that. So he gave me permission.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's the question about boundaries and transgression and going into new territory.
And I think, I mean, just as we wrap up, I think that so much of this conversation is revolved around the fact that we think of filmmaking as a kind of ultimate art or effort wherein the director exerts complete control over everything. And it's just not true. And what we learn, again, through making film and through talking about it, through living life and through experiencing death and loss, is that we cannot control ourselves or the world. We will ultimately try to exert that control and fail again and again, especially in Jackass, where they try to exert control and you know what? People end up getting hurt.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's incredibly liberating to acknowledge that. I mean, I think not having control does not take away the fact we have responsibility or we own our choices, right? Or we own what we do to other people in relationships with them.
Mm-hmm.
But like, how liberating. How liberating. I think like some of us are trying so, and I, you know, so many women trying so hard to be perfect, trying so hard to control how our life unfolds. And then it's like, oh, that's not working, right? and so, you know, I think it's incredibly liberating to share with a group of people one's not knowingness, one's lack of control, one's interest in what is unknown, which is totally what me and the crew of people who made Dick Johnson is Dead did together.
Mm-hmm.
I think the cast and crew of Jackass made those films together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're defiant sort of in the face of like death that threatens us, but like the joy that we can experience together.
Oh, that is such a great way to end this. And thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about your work and Jackass. Again, Dick Johnson is Dead is available on Netflix to watch right now. So if you've got a weekend, you've got to come on, just go and watch it. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, this has been amazing. Really great to hear about your grandfather. What an amazing person.
Oh,
and
thank you.
He will not be forgotten.
Thanks. And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at switchbladesisters@maximumfun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/switchbladesisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of maximumfun.org.
He's got my nipple, dude. He's got my fucking nipple.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.